Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and read us in your podcast app. So I want you to take a second and imagine your brain.
Just, you know, picture it sitting up there.
Right. Usually when we think about brain health, especially as we age, we tend to frame it as this biological clock winding down. Think about genetics or, I don't know, amyloid plaques, maybe cardiovascular health.
Yeah, the very standard clinical medical model.
Exactly. But I want to introduce a completely different way to look at it today. What if your brain is actually a physical, biological record of your entire social history?
Oh, that's a huge shift.
It is. Imagine every time you, say, couldn't access a doctor when you were sick, or every time you had to skip a meal just to stretch a paycheck.
Or even severe family conflicts you witnessed when you were, like, 5 years old.
Right. What if those moments didn't just fade into the past as bad memories, but actually left a tangible structural footprint inside your skull?
It completely forces a profound shift in perspective. I mean, we have to move away from the idea of the brain existing in this biological vacuum, somehow isolated from the world around it.
Yeah.
We're really starting to understand it as an organ that is constantly, just relentlessly being sculpted by our social environment.
Okay, let's unpack this, because that shift in perspective is the entire mission of today's deep dive. But before we get into the weeds, today we celebrate the work of the Red Lat Consortium, who have advanced our understanding of how the social exposome impacts brain health.
It's an incredible group of researchers.
It really is. We are looking at their massive, incredibly complex 2025 study published in Nature Communications. And what immediately caught my attention is the sheer scale of this.
Yeah, they definitely did not cut any corners here.
Well, they didn't. They didn't just look at a few dozen college students or patients in a single affluent city. They pulled data from over 2,200 individuals across 6 Latin American countries. So we're talking Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru.
Which, I have to point out, is an essential piece of context for this research. For decades, traditional research into how socioeconomic status affects cognitive decline has been heavily, heavily biased toward data from the US and Europe.
Right, the weird data.
Exactly, weird data. Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And when you rely solely on that demographic, you usually end up reducing a person's entire life experience down to like one or two easily measurable variables.
The total years of education.
Yeah, or their current household income.
Yeah.
Which is just, it's so limiting.
Right, because that misses so much of the actual human experience. A person is way more than just their tax bracket or their college degree. But why Latin America specifically for this study?
So Latin America provides a critical environment to study these factors because of its unique demographic and economic landscape. Mm-hmm. It actually has the second highest estimated global prevalence of dementia.
Wow, second highest. I didn't know that.
Yeah, which is a massive public health crisis on its own. But simultaneously, it's one of the most unequal regions in the world. You have these immense stark disparities in financial assets, access to basic healthcare, community infrastructure.
So it's basically a landscape of multifocal adversities.
Precisely. If you want to understand how chronic varied hardship impacts the brain, this is the environment where those signals are going to be the absolute strongest.
Okay, so to really grasp how these researchers managed to measure a lifetime of social experience, I think we need a mental model for you listening right now. Think of this social exposome as a backpack that you put on the day you're born.
I like that analogy.
Right. Because traditional science basically waits until you're 65 years old, takes the backpack off, puts it on a scale, and says, oh, you only have 12 years of education, your backpack is heavy. It's just a single measurement at the very end of the line.
It's a snapshot.
Yeah, exactly. But this study is doing something completely different. They were looking at every single rock put into that backpack at age 5, at age 35, and yesterday.
And the researchers formalized that concept by creating what they call the Multidimensional Social Exposome Score, or MSE.
MSE, got it.
To build this score, they didn't just ask a couple of basic demographic questions. They evaluated 319 specific items.
Wait, 319? That is a massive questionnaire.
It's incredibly thorough. They eventually scaled them from 0 to 1, across 10 distinct domains of a person's life.
I'm looking at the list of these 10 domains, and it's really comprehensive. We're talking education, food insecurity, financial status, assets, access to healthcare.
Childhood labor is on there too.
Yeah, childhood labor, subjective socioeconomic status, childhood experiences, traumatic events, and social relationships.
And they applied a lifespan approach to those domains, which is where the real depth of the data comes from. They evaluated these hardships across different distinct life stages.
Okay, I get tracking things like income or whether someone lost a job recently, but how far back does this lifespan approach really go? Are we talking about high school?
Oh, much further. Let's look at food insecurity as an example. They didn't just ask, are you struggling to buy groceries today? They asked if your family had to eat less or rely on nutrient-poor diets due to economic hardship between the ages of 0 and 10.
Wow.
Then they asked about the period when you were 35 to 45. Then they asked about your recent history.
So they are tracking the chronic nature of the hardship over time.
Yes. And they did the exact same thing for healthcare access. They looked at whether you had difficulty paying for medical services or if you faced systemic barriers like transportation issues, living too far from clinics.
Or even lacking someone to accompany you to appointments, right?
Exactly. And they tracked those barriers across your entire life. They went deep into childhood experiences, documenting the number of children in your household, whether you were forced to leave school early to support the family financially.
Which goes back to the childhood labor domain.
Right. They looked at exposure to alcohol or drug abuse in the home, severe family conflicts, and even emotional metrics like the frequency of feeling loved and receiving physical affection as a child.
That's heavy. Every single one of those is a rock in the backpack. And it sounds like some people are carrying boulders before they even reach their teenage years.
They really are. The methodology allowed the researchers to combine all of these separate variables into a single cumulative score. This captures the true multidimensional burden of a person's life.
It stops treating a lack of education or low income as these isolated, sterile control variable.
Yeah, starts treating them as an interconnected web of social realities.
Okay, I see how rigorous the data collection is, but I'm reading this and thinking about the timeline, and a massive red flag pops up for me.
Let's hear it.
Wait, couldn't this just be reverse causation? Like, let's say someone is 55 and they start developing early symptoms of dementia. They might start making mistakes at work, maybe forgetting appointments. Eventually, they lose their job.
Which triggers severe financial stress.
Exactly. Suddenly, they can't afford quality groceries, and they have to sell their smartphone to pay rent. If we measure them at age 60, they have a massive adversity score. But the brain disease caused the poverty, not the other way around.
That is the fundamental trap of observational research, and it's a completely critical lens to apply here. The researchers anticipated this exact problem of reverse causation.
Oh, they did?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What's fascinating here is how they avoided circular associations. They painstakingly designed the questionnaire to exclude any items that could be directly influenced by the onset of dementia symptoms.
So they actively stripped out anything that could just be a side effect of losing cognitive function.
They did.
Yeah.
Current smartphone use, current engagement in work activities, recent changes in financial management, those were all removed from the final MSE score.
That's smart.
And furthermore, they didn't just rely on survey design. They strictly controlled for disease severity in their statistical models. They factored in the patient's age at diagnosis and the specific number of years that had elapsed since the diagnosis.
So by neutralizing the current disease state, they are isolating the actual lifelong environmental impact.
Yes.
They're measuring the true weight of that backpack from the past, completely independent of how far along the dementia is today.
That's the goal. They wanted the absolute cleanest possible look at how historical, lifelong social environments correlate with current brain health.
Okay, so the data is cleared of reverse causation. The backpack is accurately weighed. Let's shift to the clinical reality then. What actually happens to the people carrying the heaviest backpacks across this sample of 2,200 individuals?
The baseline behavioral finding is incredibly stark. Across the entire cohort, a more adverse, multidimensional social exposome directly correlated with diminished cognitive function.
So worse memory, worse processing speed.
Exactly. It also correlated with decreased functional ability, meaning the basic capability to perform activities of daily living, and a heightened presence of neuropsychiatric symptoms like depression or agitation.
But the data splits in a really revealing way when you look at the specific groups within the study, right? Because they had a group of healthy aging individuals, And then they had people already diagnosed with dementia, specifically Alzheimer's disease and frontotemporal lobar degeneration, or FTLD.
Right. And the predictors of decline shifted dramatically depending on which group you look at. For the healthy aging controls, the biggest predictors of cognitive decline were largely what you might expect based on older literature.
Which is what?
A lack of physical assets and lower education.
Which makes sense. I mean, education builds cognitive reserve and assets provide stability. But for the dementia groups, the Alzheimer's and FTLD patients, those factors kind of fade into the background. It wasn't just about whether you owned a house or finished high school anymore.
No, for those dealing with neurodegenerative disease, basic survival metrics completely took over the predictive models.
Wow.
The most critical predictors of functional and cognitive decline became lifelong food insecurity, financial status, and access to healthcare, alongside subjective socioeconomic status.
Subjective meaning how poor someone actually felt compared to others around them.
Exactly.
So for someone already battling a brain disease, the lack of basic physiological needs like food and medical care accelerates the decline far more than a lack of education. So, what does this all mean for the combined score? Because you mentioned they put all this together. Why is the combined score so important?
The researchers used these advanced statistical filtering techniques to determine which variables actually carried weight. Without getting bogged down in the math, they proved that the cumulative MSE score was a vastly stronger predictor of cognitive decline than any single isolated factor.
Meaning the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
Consider two patients with Alzheimer's. You can't just look at one and say, well, they only had 6 years of formal education. So that entirely explains their severe cognitive decline.
Right, it's too simplistic.
Because if that same person also faced childhood labor, chronic family conflict, a lack of physical affection at home, and lifelong food insecurity, the combined weight of those interconnected adversities damages their clinical profile far more than just the lack of education alone. The sum of our social hardships uniquely degrades our biological resilience.
Okay, so we know the social backpack predicts functional decline on paper tests. But, you know, paper tests are one thing. It's an entirely different level of proof to say we can literally see poverty and chronic stress on an MRI scan. If this burden is as severe as the behavioral data suggests, shouldn't we be able to see the damage inside the skull?
We should, and they looked for exactly that. They used neuroimaging techniques to look at structural atrophy, which is the actual physical shrinking and loss of brain tissue.
Wait, I saw the term voxel-based morphometry in the methodology. Let's translate that for those of us without a neuroscience background. What are we actually looking at on these scans?
Sure. Think of a voxel as a three-dimensional pixel. Voxel-based morphometry is just a computational approach that allows researchers to measure differences in the local concentrations of brain tissue, specifically gray matter, across different subjects.
Oh, okay. So it lets them pinpoint exactly where tissue volume is decreasing.
Exactly.
So they are mapping the exact coordinates of where the brain is physically shrinking. What did they find? Where does social adversity live in the brain of an Alzheimer's patient?
In patients with Alzheimer's disease, a higher adverse MSE SO, a heavier backpack of lifetime hardship, was linked to significantly reduced gray matter in the frontal lobes, the insula, and most notably, the cerebellum.
The cerebellum, that's the structure at the very back and bottom of the brain, right? I feel like whenever we talk about Alzheimer's and memory, the focus is always on the hippocampus. The cerebellum is usually just talked about for motor coordination, like balance, typing, or walking.
Yeah, and you're touching on a major historical blind spot in neuroscience. The cerebellum is often completely ignored in older dementia literature, precisely because it was viewed mainly as the brain's motor coordination center.
So why is it shrinking here?
Because this study highlights a much more complex role. The cerebellum is shrinking in response to social adversity because it is a core structure in what we call the allostatic interoceptive network.
Okay, we definitely need to define that. Allostatic interoceptive network. Let's break that down.
Think of allostasis as the body's active process of maintaining stability through change. It's basically how you adapt to stress.
Okay.
When you face constant, lifelong social adversity, chronic food insecurity, financial panic, trauma, your body is constantly bathed in stress hormones like cortisol. You never get to return to a true baseline.
So you're just always on high alert.
Always. And this leads to something called allostatic overload. The allostatic interoceptive network is the specific brain system that monitors and processes this internal physiological stress.
So it's the network that literally feels the physical toll of chronic anxiety and hardship.
Yes. And because the cerebellum is a key node in this network, chronic social stress essentially wears it down. The constant demand of processing survival-level stress makes the tissue highly vulnerable to neurodegeneration.
So the network responsible for managing stress is the exact network being eroded by it. It's a brutal biological feedback loop.
It really is. And the physical evidence doesn't stop at just the size of the brain structures. The researchers also used resting state functional MRI to look at how the different parts of the brain communicate with each other.
Right, functional connectivity. Looking at the brain's wiring and electrical traffic, what did the traffic patterns look like for people with high adversity?
Well, in Alzheimer's patients, a more adverse social exposome was associated with lower connectivity in certain frontotemporal areas. The standard communication lines were breaking down, which is expected in neurodegeneration.
Yeah, that tracks.
But here's where it gets really interesting. These same patients facing high social adversity also showed higher connectivity between the frontal, temporal, and occipital regions. The brain was actually sending more signals across these specific alternate networks.
Wait, so the main network is failing, but the brain is firing more elsewhere. Is it trying to compensate? Because is this like a car engine working overtime and rerouting power because the main cylinders are failing? Like the computer starts dumping fuel into the remaining cylinders and running them at the red line just to keep the car moving at highway speeds?
We call that compensatory hyperconnectivity, and your engine analogy captures the mechanics of it perfectly.
Wow.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the brain is incredibly plastic. When faced with the structural decay from Alzheimer's pathology, combined with the accumulated wear and tear of lifelong social stress, the brain is desperately trying to bridge the gaps.
It's rewiring on the fly.
Exactly. It's rerouting signals, working overtime to maintain baseline cognitive function despite the physical damage to its primary networks.
So the brain is actively fighting back against the environment. Did they see this same hyperconnectivity in the FTLD patients or just the Alzheimer's group?
They saw this compensatory effort much more strongly in the Alzheimer's patients. FTLD typically has a younger, faster onset. Alzheimer's, on the other hand, involves a prolonged accumulation of pathology over decades.
Oh, I see.
That longer timeline in Alzheimer's, paired with a lifetime of environmental exposures, seems to trigger a more robust, long-term compensatory effort by the brain networks. The brain just has more time to try and rewire around the damage.
Okay, so we have profound behavioral data showing cognitive decline. We have structural MRI data showing actual gray matter loss in the stress processing centers. And we have functional MRI data showing the networks working overtime to compensate.
A lot of converging evidence.
Right. But I know there is a skeptical listener out there right now looking at the methodology. You're pulling neuroimaging data from 6 different countries. You've got MRIs from a clinic in Argentina, a hospital in Mexico, a research center in Chile, different magnetic field strengths, different software versions. I mean, I'm trying to picture how they even control for that. How do we know these brain scan differences aren't just a massive MRI glitch?
It's a completely valid scientific concern. In any multi-center neuroimaging study, what we call scanner effects can easily contaminate your data. A machine in Peru might just inherently produce a slightly darker image than a machine in Brazil.
Exactly.
But the RedLAC consortium applied an extraordinary level of mathematical rigor to bulletproof this data against those exact variables.
How do you mathematically level the playing field for completely different machines?
First, they ran standard statistical controls for age, sex, and total intracranial volume, so they accounted for the overall size of the person's head. But for the scanners themselves, they used a harmonization strategy. They essentially calibrated the voxel intensity values across all the different MRI scans to a unified standard, and they included the specific scanner type as a covariate in their regression models to filter out any machine-specific biases.
So they mathematically scrubbed the hardware differences out of the images.
They did. And they went further to test the integrity of the results. Yeah. They checked to see if the MSC score correlated with the MRI signal-to-noise ratio. They checked for head motion artifacts, asking the question, you know, did people with harder lives just move their heads more in the scanner, causing blurry images?
Oh, that's a clever check. And the result of all that filtering?
No correlation to the artifacts whatsoever. The statistical models held up completely. The biological embedding of social disparities remained rock solid regardless of the country, the demographic imbalances, or the specific MRI scanner used.
The brain changes are undeniably real.
They are real.
Which brings us to the ultimate question for you listening right now. We've gone deep into the methodology, the Latin American context, the breakdown of the cerebellum, and the rigorous machine controls. But what is the central insight here? For me, it's that we can no longer view brain health in a vacuum. A person's cognitive decline isn't just a biological clock winding down. It is the culmination of a lifetime of social, financial, and emotional environments.
And that realization mandates a massive shift in how the medical community and society at large approaches dementia.
Yeah, how so?
For so long, the focus has been overwhelmingly on finding a pharmaceutical cure, prescribing a pill to clear out amyloid plaques or untangle tau proteins. But this study proves that if we actually want to treat and prevent dementia, especially in underserved regions, we have to move beyond the clinic walls.
We have to actively address structural inequalities.
Exactly. We need to treat food insecurity, unequal healthcare access, and childhood poverty as neurological risk factors, with the exact same urgency that we treat high blood pressure or genetic predispositions.
It completely reframes how we interact with the people around us. I mean, understanding this data helps us look at our aging loved ones, and frankly ourselves, with so much more empathy. When you interact with someone experiencing cognitive decline, you aren't just seeing a disease taking hold, you are interacting with a lifetime of experiences, struggles, and invisible weights that they've been carrying since they were a child.
It really makes the invisible visible. The social environment is literally wired into us. It shapes the physical architecture of our minds.
Which leaves me with a final lingering thought for you to mull over today. If our lifetime social exposome physically shapes our brain structure, if the stress of food insecurity and financial panic leaves a permanent mark on the cerebellum, how will the unique chronic societal stressors of our current era be embedded in our brains 30 or 40 years from now?
That's a haunting question.
Right. When researchers in the 2060s look at our generation's MRIs, what biological footprint will build global instability, constant digital isolation, and the chronic low-grade stress of the modern world leave in the physical wiring of our minds? What invisible rocks are we putting in our backpacks today?
That is a complex and entirely necessary question to be asking as we look to the future of neuroscience.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Turn the damage back around. Change the route from the
dawn breaking.
Oh.